This episode contains some swearing. We can't help that. It's because the two authors that we're interviewing happen to have written books that both have swearing in their titles. So if you can't cope with words ruder than fufu, dong, or shirt potatoes, may I suggest you listen to one of our other episodes.
We'd Like a Word.
Welcome back to part two of We'd Like a Word, talking about self-help books, with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
And our guests, Daniel Fryer and John Williams. So, Daniel, REBT, Rational Emotive Behaviour Therapy.
Yes.
And what is that?
It's actually the first form of CBT, cognitive behaviour therapy, ever invented. And it was developed by a guy called Albert Ellis in the 1950s. Sadly, he's deceased. But it's a therapy that's kind of sailed under the radar a little bit. Very few people outside the world of psychotherapy have even heard of it, including people who have actually had it as their main form of therapy previously, mainly because it just gets all lumped under the banner of CBT. And so you turn up, you see a therapist, they say, and you say, I am a CBT therapist, and you might not clearly define which one it is you're getting. And it kind of, because it sails under the radar, it doesn't quite get the recognition that I think it deserves.
What is it?
It's a therapy that challenges your thoughts. Its whole ethos is that it's not the events in life that disturb you, it's what you tell yourself about those events that disturb you. So if you are stuck, if you are kicking off, if you are reacting in ways that you do not like but don't seem to be able to change, it is not because of the thing, it's because of the interpretation of the thing. Change the interpretation, change your reaction. Because you can't always change things, but you can change how you react in the face of those things by modulating your thought processes. With REBT, hence the title of the book, there are four main beliefs, four specific thoughts, which trigger every other kind of dysfunctional thought and feeling and behaviour and emotion and symptom that you can think of.
And what are those four thoughts?
First of all, there is the dogmatic demand. So you highlighted one of mine already. You must not get in my way. It's a rigid, absolute belief that disturbs you. And it's also usually the rigid expression of a desire for something. So I don't like people getting in my way. In my head has become, so you mustn't, ever, end of. And it's very unrealistic because people get in your way. Doesn't make sense to say you mustn't get in my way just because I don't want you to, because the world doesn't bend to my will. And it doesn't help me. All it means is when people get in my way, I kick off in anger. People who hold these rigid demands have a tendency to awfulize, to blow things out of a proportion, to make them worse than they actually are. I call it doing a drama in the book, but Albert Ellis called it awfulizing. You're just blowing everything out of proportion. And people who hold demands also have a tendency to exhibit what's known as low frustration tolerance, which is an attack of the I can't copes. So I was going, it is awful when people get in my way and I cannot cope. It's intolerable to me when people get in my way. And the final one is, I call it a pejorative put down. Albert Ellis called it damning. And you can put yourself down. I'm rubbish, I'm stupid, I'm a failure. You can put other people down. You're a pillock, you're stupid, you're a failure. You can even put things down. So my job is completely rubbish. My relationship is completely useless. We just write things off with these put downs. And every single one of those unhealthy beliefs has a rational, healthy equivalent that will help change your unhealthy negative emotion that has you reacting in ways that you don't want into what we call a healthy negative emotion that may not be positive.
So it acknowledges the problem. Yeah. It acknowledges that you feel bad about it, but it allows you to kind of react in a more proportionate
Absolutely.
Sort of way.
Yeah.
Well, this links us nicely into John's first book, which was Screw Work, Less Play. Now you were writing about, I mean, looking at your own life, you didn't like what you were doing in your job, did you? Where were you with Deloitte at the time, weren't you?
I'd already left Deloitte.
So you had left Deloitte, by the way.
It was based on my experience escaping Deloitte and starting a new career, running live events and stuff like that. And I'd managed to create custom jobs. So I'd been quite creative in my career. I'd had freelance jobs, consulting and all sorts of stuff. Got paid very well. And so it was a capturing of everything I'd learned together. But yeah, I was at Deloitte and had a very good job as a senior managing consultant, but I didn't like it at all. It's too corporate for me. I was not great senior managing consultant at Deloitte, to be honest. I was good at other things. And so I just was determined to leave. And when I finally extracted myself from there after 1 year, I made a pledge that I would never have a job for the rest of my life. And I've stuck to it. There's been times early on in my career where that was not easy to stick to. You know, it's like, how am I going to make money? What am I doing here?
It's a brave move. I mean, 10 years ago, last week, in fact, I left a steady job and thought, I'm going to try and be a freelance. And there were fallow times and there were good times. But I've gone through that last 10 years has flown by and I've had a fantastic time. It's a really... But I had the safety net because I had a pension from my previous job that at least I had a little safety net to keep me held there. I mean, what can people do if they're really in a job they hate and there's something else they want to do? How can they make that leap without having that kind of safety net?
Well, having gone through this with thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, of varying different depths on courses I run, I've realised that there are distinctive phases from where you are now to having your own successful venture that makes money that you really enjoy. And the very first phase is working out what you want to do. A huge number of people get stuck at that phase. So
it's surprisingly hard, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really. Because in actual fact, there, in some ways, the rest is relatively simple, in my opinion. I'm not sure everyone else would agree. Because the what do I want to do requires, it's kind of a therapeutic question, and it brings up existential angst. And so you have to know yourself. And the problem is if people don't, I actually try not to get involved too much with people who've got no idea what they're doing. Because the solution is actually therapy.
But that's the human race.
Yeah, I know. Well, okay.
You can't help everyone all the time.
But if they don't know whether they want to be, a nurse or a computer programmer, it's a long journey to go through that process. Because normally... that's because you don't know yourself enough. So you haven't worked out what it is you like and you don't like. So there's a phase right at the beginning where if the first book is about this, so it does help with that. Screw Work, Let's Play. But if you actually just ask yourself, I'm in a men's group and I came up with a friend last night who was in the men's group. And I was saying to him, like, you've got to carry a notebook everywhere with you and write down what you like and what you don't like. And every time you notice something you like, you write it down. Every time you notice something you don't like, you write it down. Because you're getting to know yourself. Now, it was for different reasons for him. But if you want to work out what to do with your career, you've got to work that out. So when you notice you work with somebody that make you feel really good, and you work with somebody else, it should be working, and they're really good at what they do. For some reason, you feel really uncomfortable, write it down. Because this is all information. So I'm at the point now where I know myself really well. And it's a really useful thing to get to. So that's the first phase you've got to do. And it would be a very bad idea to quit your job not having been through that process. When people do that, it never goes well. So you've got to have some idea what you want to do by knowing yourself. But also then, if you're exploring like business options, you then can't just sit and think and navel gaze. You have to do things. So because when you're at school, the answer to everything is just think harder. Like if you don't have the answer to a maths question, sit there and think about it longer. That doesn't work with career choices. The only thing that works with career choices is for you to experience things. So if you think, I have people go like, could I ever be a writer? I go, well, have you tried picking up a piece of, pen and a piece of paper and writing? Because you are now a writer. I mean, okay, you're not getting paid, but the way to find out whether you enjoy writing is to write. The way to find out if you enjoy helping people in some way or other is to go help them. You can do it for free. You can do it in the evenings. You can do it the weekends. So that's the next phase. It's kind of exploring ideas that you could pursue. And then you choose one. And then I recommend that most people get a start on that while they're still in their job. The ideal is you exit knowing what you're going to do and having made some money already and you've done it. So whatever it is you want to do as a freelance or consultant or as a business, you've actually got it off the ground. And that some people think, okay, businesses, you can't do that because you need premises and teams and it's just, loads of money and funding. I need to go on Dragon's Den. For most businesses, particularly if the product is really just the contents of your brain, which an awful lot of us, this is what we get paid for, right? we get paid for something. You and a laptop and a mobile phone is basically, you could do what you do in your job from anywhere in the world, if, assuming you're not a farmer, you don't work in a shop or something like that.
So it's not like have the business plan all laid out, just try it a bit.
You don't really, for most people, you don't really need a business plan. What you need, there's this phrase in the startup world, and I spend my life taking people through this process, and people don't see it until you explain it to them. The startup world talks about a thing called product market fit, and that is the hardest part of making a business or a freelance or a consulting career work. Product market fit is when you've taken everything you want to do, like in a startup, it's about software, but it's the same if you want to become, you know, you've got a funky idea for a live event or a podcast or something. What you have to do is you work out how to take your ideas and your expertise and the things you're good at, and maybe your friends if they're involved, and pour it into a package and try it out with a particular kind of person, like a particular audience, and find if they will buy it. And that's actually one of the hardest parts of starting a business. Once you've done it and you've got a few people buying it, you actually then it's just the same marketing stuff that's, you know, you can Google. It's like you can run Facebook ads, you can build an email list. I mean, I teach all this stuff, but what most people do is they start with the end. So what they do is they start thinking like, oh, what should my logo be? You know, what about my business plan? Like, forget that. Go and sell something to somebody. So you call up 10 friends and go, you know, I want to interview for my podcast. Or you call up 10 people and say, I want to do a live event that's called this. That's, you know, this is the theme and this is the spin. And this is what's going to be different from other things. Do you want to come? And if people go, not really. Then you've got to rework it. You haven't found product market fit. The best way to find it is to actually sell it. So even if your friends go, oh, yeah, it's a lovely idea, you go like, well, it's going to cost 10 quid. Have you got 10 quid on you?
Oh, I'm washing my hair that night.
Yeah, and then they go, oh, can I get back to you on that? And that's the test. So that's the rubber hitting the road. So I recommend you do as much of that process as kind of all those different stages in a job. And then when you quit your job, then you've got time to just accelerate what you're already doing.
The thing I don't understand about that is your book is called Screw Work, Let's Play.
Yes.
That sounds like a lot of hard work. It could be a job that you enjoy doing. I mean, you enjoy writing, yeah, Steve. Yeah. It's a lot of hard work. You enjoy what you do, don't you? But you haven't worked for anyone. You're an independent, but it sounds like you're still working hard.
So, yeah, no, absolutely. So the way I explain it in Screw Well Let's Play is that it's not about not having to put any effort in. Like, this is not the 4-hour work week, because, you know, even Tim Ferriss doesn't work 4 hours. He loves what he does, so he does loads of it. He doesn't need to, actually. He's just got enough money from shares, he doesn't need to. But what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to help people do, is find a career that feels like such a good fit, that's enjoyable and exciting and also stressful at times, and is full of personal growth or whatever it is you want from a career, so that even if you won the lottery, you would still want to do it in some form or other. So if suddenly somebody handed me, you know, 10 million quid and I never needed to work ever again, then I would still be writing. I'd still be coming on podcasts. I would still be doing books and blogging. I'd still be wanting to meet people, even if it was over coffee for free, and go, what's your business idea? What's the problem? So I'd be doing the bulk of this. I'd also be having ideas and creating products and launching things online and posting funny stuff on Facebook, which I'll spend some of my day doing. You know, I'd probably do less of it, that's all, because I'm quite lazy. But that's what we're trying to find.
It's interesting on the writing thing, because obviously I wanted to make that move from, as you know, I was a police officer for 30 years and I wanted to make the move into writing. So as I was coming up towards retirement, I did exactly as you advised. I started pushing a few bits out to magazines and pushing stuff around publishers and sent a few things into Radio 4, and that got me the attention of this, that and the other. And I eventually managed to get what I wanted. But it was hard work. I mean, as you say, I mean, the Screw Work, Let's Play, I can understand it's got to be a bit of a soundbitey sort of title if you want to capture people's attention to sell the book. But it's not so much screw work. It's screw doing work you don't want to do.
Yeah, it's more
it's more sort of work for what you want.
It's more about screw the 9-to-5. Like, to me, even if I was doing what I'm doing now, if I had to go to the same place every day and be in that god-awful Deloitte building that I used to be in, it was like a mausoleum. And, you know, with these people around me who I didn't share any values with.
Other awful companies are available. just got to say on the website.
Yeah, but someone's awful company is someone else's.
Well, that's the point. There's other people who love working at Deloitte.
It would have been people's dream job to be senior managing consultant at Deloitte. It just didn't suit me. So that's that's what it's about. And it's by screw work, I really mean screw the 9-to-5 and screw doing anything you don't want to do, it doesn't have any meaning to you.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's not about, you know, tripping through the roses forever and the daisies and being blissfully happy. The life I want is one that is continually interesting and actually continually challenging, and I'm learning all the time, and there's variety and autonomy. That's what, and the word play, actually, I do explain, has multiple meanings. So play is always a choice. That's the decider. It's not actually always fun. I mean, you know, the England football team playing football, they're doing what they love, but sometimes it's really, really hard and grim. And it's not all, you know, certainly not all smiles.
certainly isn't for the managers.
When it comes to penalties. Yeah.
I always feel sorry for football managers.
Oh, yeah, they never get... They can't win.
They can't win, can they? Their players can go out and do their very, very best and lose, and they get sacked. I mean, it makes no sense.
Yeah. But there's other means of play. So, first of all, you can't point a gun at someone's head and say, okay, you play now, because now whatever they're doing is not play.
Yeah.
So it's always a choice. The second thing is it's about playing out your career. So one of the principles I talk about in Screw It, Let's Play is that you're never going to, you know, the days when you picked a goal off in the distance and it was a straight line to get there are long gone. And in fact, the most interesting careers, as yours has been, Stephen, and mine, and probably yours, Daniel's, and yours, I'm sure, have been about just doing what you're drawn to do next. And that gives, for me, the most fulfilling life. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to cheat death by having the most fulfilling life possible. So the life feels as full and as lengthy, and I have as few regrets as possible when I get to the end of it. And so that's part of it as well. That's part of the play concept.
So it's interesting. I was talking to a listener about both your books, and she was saying the things that work for her is it's good if there's a personal story and evidence of the thought process that you went through to come up with your philosophy or your approach, and examples. And this is Sue Verhoeven, name checker. And
hello.
A more conversational approach, so you hear the voice of the person who you're reading, or if it's an audiobook, you know, literally who you're listening to, rather than, I suppose, somebody just pretending that this is something completely new, which they're regurgitating without putting their own stamp on it. And you've both done that. I mean, would you agree it's essential you have to share a personal story to make it connect with people?
You have to share stories. We're all natural storytellers. There has to be a story in there. I share my story just because I wanted to kick that off and frame the book. I also share anecdotes from therapy with other people, so other people's stories are there. But yeah, if you, especially with therapy, you know, if you're going to write a therapy book or if you're going to be a therapist, you've got to have stuff. I mean, some therapists are technically competent. They know their stuff very, very well, but they've never been through it themselves, so they lack that personal element. But if you sat there and gone, right, well, these are my challenges, and this is how I dealt with them, and this is how I come out the other side, then there's the technical competency, and then there's the real-world application. It's like if you're going to see a counsellor for drugs and alcohol, you want a counsellor that's fallen off the wayside more than once or twice in their life to take you through that journey, rather than somebody that's just technically competent. Your story draws them in. Your story lets them know you know what you're doing.
I'd agree with all of that. I think stories, first of all, are very engaging to read in a book. I noticed that the non-fiction books I liked had stories that drew you in.
Yep.
And then if you can take examples from your own life and show that you've learned from them, I think people definitely like that, and I find that encouraging. I find increasingly experts who don't share anything of themselves a little bit frustrating. I think things have changed from the anonymous expert of I don't know what, 20 years ago or more, to the point where your personal brand is very much part of it. The people who are really successful in the non-fiction world and in the guru space, the guru industry.
The guru space.
The expert industry, some people call it. That they show themselves very much and they're very authentic. So they show their flaws as well. When Tim Ferriss came on the scene and he wrote this book, The 4-Hour Workweek, probably lots of people have heard of, and it was it had a massive impact, sold a huge amount, and it's about this new way of working. It came out about a year before mine. I was already writing mine when it came out. And when he first came out, he tried to be this sort of like super successful guy who had no faults whatsoever. And I was slightly intimidated by that, if I'm being really honest. But also it's difficult to relate. For me, it's difficult to relate to somebody who appears to have everything worked out. And then a few years later, he admitted, actually, there are mornings I can't get out of bed. And he admitted that he was suicidal at one point in his life. And so now I'm going like, oh, OK, he's as fucked up as the rest of us. Now I'm engaged. It's like that's really what I want to know.
Well, there is a thing called the pratfall effect, isn't there? That we find people more endearing and more trustworthy if we can see that they're not perfect.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that I was reading something about this just recently, that if you're looking at something like your ratings on Amazon or something like that, you know, because all authors are obsessed with checking their ratings. If you've got nothing but 5-star reviews for your product, your sales will drop off because people look at it and think, oh, well, obviously, you're just making those up. No one's perfect.
Yeah.
If you've got about 4.4, 4.8, you know, people are quite happy with that.
There's an idea in marketing called the damaging admission. So everything we've learned, the kind of things you deal with, Daniel, and you write about, Stephen, with cognitive biases, marketers just eat that stuff up because then you can use it to basically remote control human beings and get them to buy what you want.
Yeah.
And so one of the classic things, one of the classic constructs in copywriting is the damaging omission. So you open by saying, you know, like a classic email title is, I messed up. And it, when people see that come in, you get a very, very high open rate. Now you see people gaming it and then they go, I messed up, you know, I sold millions of copies of my book or course or whatever it was, but I could have sold many more because I should have charged twice as much. Get it while it's still cheap. So it can become very cheesy, but it's a well-known marketing ploy.
Well, Avis had a fantastic campaign a few years ago where they really got a chunk in the market by admitting they weren't the best.
Yes.
It was like, we're number two, so we try harder.
Yes. Yep.
Or, you know, we may not be number one, but the queues are shorter at our stores. Come and give us a try. Things like that. I mean, it's a brilliant idea.
And on that note, we're coming to the end of part two. In part three, we'll be hearing what Daniel did before this. It's quite a surprising thing. And look into some of the offbeat things that John does. On part three of We'd Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.